Chapter 9. Numa Vessel Raleigh. The sun was dropping toward the horizon by the time Kurt and Joe climbed back onto the Raleigh's main submersible. To the east, the sea continued burning, a nautical vision of Hades, obscured by smoke and blurred by waves of heat. With Joe already at the controls, Kurt climbed in and sealed the hatch. Kurt took the briefest glimpse at the inferno and then gave a thumbs up to the crane operator. The submersible was lifted off the deck, swung out over the side, and lowered into the water. "Once more unto the breach," he said, settling in beside Joe. "We're going to cause our own breach," Joe said. "So, technically..." "Right," Kurt said. "Let's go." Joe opened the valves and the sound of air rushing out of the tanks roared in their ears until it was replaced by a soothing quiet as the submersible dove beneath the waves. A mile from the nearest fire, the sea appeared serene, at least until a flickering glow became obvious in the distance. "Coming up on the outer fires," Joe said. Their progress was being monitored by Brooks, Cox, and the others back in Oslo. Brooks replied to Joe's comment over the radio. "Outer fires confirmed. Steer 5 degrees to port and you should have smooth sailing through to the next danger zone." "Strange that they have a better view of things up there than we do down here," Joe said. "I imagine the tiny icon of our sub looking like the miniature sub in Fantastic Voyage." Kurt laughed. "And yet I'm stuck in here with you instead of Jessica Chastain." As Joe made the course correction, Kurt slid a control panel with a lighted keyboard in front of him. From it, he could control the submersible's robotic arms. "Leveling off," Joe said, "continuing east." "We see you," Brooks replied. "In a quarter mile, you'll be closing in on what's left of the vertical shaft that blew out under the Alpha Star. All you'll see is a column of fire, but sonar confirms there is still metal debris in there, so watch yourselves." Kurt could sense a backseat driver situation forming, one drawback to having the Oslo system in full swing. "Campfire dead ahead," Joe said. "Hope you brought the marshmallows." "Fresh out," Kurt said. "How about 50 pounds of C4? "That ought to liven things up." The radio came to life again. This time it was Cox. "You boys are approaching the main transfer line now." "I'm not seeing anything," Joe replied. "The line is buried, but you'll see a distinctive bulge running perpendicular to your position. Follow that, and it'll lead you back beneath the Alpha Star." Kurt spotted the bulge in the sediment and pointed. "I see it," Joe said. "Commencing turn." They followed the raised line of sediment toward their destination, passing between two fiery eruptions along the way. Kurt noticed the columns of flame beginning life in narrow, concentrated jets, and then widening as they went upward. "Whatever this hydrophoric gas is, it's blasting out of the pipes at high pressure." As they neared the fires, a rumbling sound reverberated through the steel hull of the sub. "Sounds like a freight train," Joe said. Kurt would have agreed, but the racket became so intense that it blocked out all conversation. Up close, the fountain of flame became too bright to look at, and Kurt averted his eyes, looking beneath the point of ignition. He saw a crater in the seafloor and a broken pipe, bent and splayed outward. With the fire behind them, the sound levels returned to normal, and the seafloor ahead was lit up like a sandy beach on a sunny day. "Next thing you should see is a group of exposed pipes, a 3-into-1 connector, and then the valve assembly sticking out of the silt like a tree trunk. 50 feet beyond that is the best spot to place the explosives." Joe brought them over the valve assembly and down onto the raised section of sediment. "This looks like the spot." "Hold her steady," Kurt said. Using the keyboard, he activated one of the submersible's robotic arms, powering up a water jet contained in the arm and blasting away the sediment. A swirling cloud engulfed, drifting away only after Kurt shut off the water jet and focused on the newly exposed pipe, which was as thick as a telephone pole. What had once been gray-painted steel was now covered in barnacles and flakes of rust. "Pipe exposed," Kurt said. He retracted the first robotic arm and extended a second. Gripped in the claw at the end of this arm was a large block of C4 connected to a detonator and a circular band that would allow them to clip the explosives to the pipe. The band was open at one end and would slip over the pipe with a slight shove, clipping on like a bracelet. "Don't bump it too hard," Joe said. "The pressure in that line is nearly 10,000 PSI, and there's no telling if the other explosions damaged it. I'll be gentle, Kurt insisted. With a deft hand, Kurt forced the clip onto the pipe, and it locked into place. Easy peasy, he said. Now back us off. Joe engaged the propellers once more, and the sub pulled away from the pipe. As they moved back, a thin wire spooled out. 100 feet out, Joe slowed to a halt and held station. Setting the countdown for 15 minutes, Kurt said. That ought to give us time to get back on the Raleigh, crack open a beer, and settle in to watch the fireworks. With a nod from Joe, Kurt started the timer. A digital readout on the control panel flashed 15 minutes, and then began clicking down. With the timer operating, Kurt disconnected the control wire, and Joe spun the sub around to take them out. Up in the Oslo compartment, Captain Brooks watched on the remote screen as the timer started clicking down. Cox stood over the fish tank, watching the tiny electronic version of the submersible navigate back along the orange pipeline trail. He marveled at the detail. I feel like Zeus, looking down on the world from Mount Olympus. More like Poseidon, the captain replied. But I know what you're saying. I've almost gotten used to it now, but I remember feeling the same way the first time we used it on a salvage operation. Circling around the display, Cox studied the shattered arrangement of pipes, the bits of wreckage that had come off the Alpha Star that now littered the seafloor, and the miniature version of the slow-moving sub that Kurt and Joe were piloting. To his surprise, it wasn't the only thing moving in the tank. What's this? Brooks looked his way. What's what? There's another guppy in your tank. Captain Brooks crouched down beside Cox, took a long, hard look, and then shook his head. Reaching for the control panel, he tapped the key to zoom in. He tapped it once, twice, and then a third time. After the third increase in magnification, he could clearly make out a disc-shaped object moving to the south. It flickered, reappeared, and then vanished again. Is that a glitch? Cox asked. I don't think so, the captain said grimly. The tank can only show us what the sonar is picking up. The fires, venting gas, and wreckage are blocking the signal in places, causing it to cut out. But there was something there, all right. Brooks picked up the phone and contacted the bridge. Helm, give us 5 knots and pull us around to the northeast. Have the sonar team max out the pulse if they haven't already. Brooks continued scanning the display as the ship began to move. For several moments, there was nothing to see. And then the red disc reappeared. Looks like a frisbee, Cox said, or a flying saucer. Which seems appropriate, Brooks said, since it's completely unidentifiable. Brooks pressed the intercom button again, this time reaching out to the sonar operations room. Sonar, this is the captain. I'm down in Oslo. We're seeing a contact bearing 045, depth 850 feet, heading directly for the danger zone. Any chance this is an artifact or a biological reading? Negative, the sonar operator said. Speed and sound profile indicate electrically powered water jets. What does that mean? Cox asked. It means Kurt and Joe have company.